I had heard, this is what I've heard, that they might have the skull of Geronimo there, that they stole it from somewhere.
Yeah, of all the rumored items that are supposedly in the tomb, I think the Geronimo skull is a pretty plausible one, actually. According to the text of what seems to me to be an authentic Skull and Bones document, it talks about how George W. Bush's grandfather Prescott and some fellow bonesmen robbed the grave of the Apache chief and deposited the remains in Skull and Bones. They wrote in the document, basically they wrote about this experience, sort of bragging about it for the society, and I can read a little bit about it if you want.
Yeah, just a bit. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, this happened in 1918 when Prescott Bush and a few other members of Skull and Bones were stationed at the Army base at Fort Sill. The document talks about how they brought to the T its most spectacular crook. In Bones language, T means tomb and crook means theft. And then they went on to say, the skull of Geronimo the Terrible, the Indian chief who had taken 49 white scalps. They say an expedition planned with great caution since six army captains robbing a grave wouldn't look good in the papers. Then they go on to describe how they pried open the door of the tomb with an axe. They dug. Bush was the first one to start digging. The other alumni or patriarchs found a bridle, a saddle horn, and rotten leathers. They cleaned the skull with carbolic acid. They say the skull was very clean, having only some flesh inside and a little hair. And what's interesting is that the document describes, it names three people. There are six bonesmen there, but it names three of them: Prescott Bush, Ellery James, and Neil Mallon. Well, these people later became Prescott Bush, the future senator and grandfather of and father of the presidents. Bush family friend Neil Mallon was the CEO of Dresser Industries, and Ellery James became a Brown Brothers Harriman partner. So these are pretty high-profile men who allegedly robbed this grave.
Pretty darn prominent. Now, have you ever been inside the tomb?
No, I would not go in the tomb. I think there were probably several ways I could have, but knowing Skull and Bones, I didn't want to give them any fodder in case they wanted to come after me later.
Now, were you told what it looked like on the inside?
Yes. By dozens of people.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that, and then your methodology for how you were able to talk to, because you did talk to a lot of Skull and Bones members. What did they tell you, though, Alex, about how, and I can call you that for short, because that's what you call yourself sometimes,
sure.
Right? Okay. How did they describe the inside of this place?
Oh, it's full of skulls and skeletons, both human and animal. There's a death motif. There's a war motif. There are relics from various wars. For example, Civil War muskets were sent back to the tomb by General Russell, that's the founder of Skull and Bones, to be used in initiation rites. There are relics from World War I, World War II. There are phrases engraved in German and Latin reminding the bonesmen that they only have a short time on this earth. There's a lot of artwork celebrating death. The most grand room in the tomb is the dining room, or boodle, as they call it. And that's sort of a very large room with huge windows that looks onto a courtyard that's kind of like a secret garden for them.
Did anybody ever tell you whether somebody might have been hurt there or during any of their initiations?
People have been, I know there have been minor injuries in Skull and Bones. I know during the initiation, the initiate is sort of thrust about the tomb, and they tell him not to wear anything, they tell the initiates not to wear anything that has any metal or glass on them, because in the past it's said that initiates were accidentally thrust into inanimate objects.
Oh my. How do the members get found? Who picks them?
Well, Skull and Bones consists of 15 Yale juniors. They're tapped the April of their junior year. They come back after summer break, and they're there in the tomb every Thursday and Sunday night for their senior year. Second semester, between January and April, they pretty much focus on elections. They sift through the entire junior class looking for the people who are going to reflect honor and success back onto the society, or failing that, who are very strong legacies. They spend a long time culling through the members of the junior class.
I was going to say, legacy is important to them, isn't it?
Legacy is important. It's not as important as it was in the mid-20th century. It's become a little less important. Now it's not enough if you had a father in Skull and Bones. You need a father, a grandfather, an uncle maybe to get in.
Now, how did you go about finding Skull and Bones members to talk to?
Well, I got a copy of the membership catalog, which isn't available publicly.
How'd you get that?
Well, I wish I could tell you. but anyway, so I was able to just start locating Bonesmen and talking to them. I'd say I probably interviewed, about 150, 175, though maybe twice that number, hung up on me or harassed me or threatened me or yelled at me and what an awful thing I was doing by writing about Skull and Bones. It was rather silly the way they treated it in some cases.
Tell me some of the really most horrendous episodes when you would call someone and they'd either hang up on you or threaten you.
Oh, well, one Bonesman joked that if the society wasn't portrayed in a positive light, he would send a few of his friends after me. I think the one that appalled me the most was not somebody I called. He called me, which was a little disconcerting. My book started with an article that I wrote for the Atlantic Monthly. After that article was published, this was a few years ago, I got a call at my office from another journalist whom I knew by name, mm-hmm. who used to be a member of Skull and Bones. And he started off by scolding me for writing the article. He said writing that article was not an ethical or honorable way to make a decent living in journalism. And then he asked me how much the Atlantic had paid me for the story. Well, I don't tell people those things, so I didn't answer, and he hung up. 15 minutes later, he actually called me back, and he starts off immediately by saying, "I have just gotten off the phone with our people." And I started laughing, because this is a grown man.
Yeah, our people.
And he said that the society demanded to know where I got my information. Of course, I wasn't going to go into that. He tried to butter me up and tried to get me to tell him the names of the Bonesmen whom I had interviewed. Obviously, I wasn't going to tell him that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got angry. He screamed at me. He berated me about how, in his words, I was dishonorable for even daring to write about the secret society. And I listened only out of curiosity because I was curious where the conversation was going. Then he ended it by saying, "There are a lot of us at newspapers and at political journalism institutions across the country." And he goes, "Good luck with your career." And he slammed down the phone. Well, I was 23 when that happened.
Let me tell you, your career's been doing pretty well.
You know, I'm doing okay, although I have heard that this guy is still actively trying to destroy my career as
really?
A journalist. And I have to tell you, he'd be horrified to learn this, but it was that conversation that made me realize, you know what, I'm going to write a book now.
Had he kept quiet, you might not have done that then.
Who knows?